coming up on Curious Mix. Head spinning.
When I married Kenny, I was exposed to another world. And when I started hearing all this jazz and different styles, I loved it.
Heart open.
If you could stand on the stage inside of the dance, I don't think you could not cry.
Hands on.
We want to touch things, so I want them to touch them. And if it makes them happy, great.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer. Come listen and learn as we share a curious mix of arts and culture right after this news from NPR. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. Please touch are two words you never expect to hear in a museum. Not so if you're attending an exhibit by Native American sculptor Michael Naranjo. A grenade blast while serving in Vietnam took his eyesight and severely injured one of his hands. But the soft-spoken artist never lost his vision of becoming a sculptor. Naranjo uses bronze to create touchable art. His work is collected and displayed around the world. And in February of 2020, he brought his work to the Eiteljorg Museum in downtown Indianapolis. I met him there to talk and touch his exquisitely crafted pieces of art.
My name is Michael Naranjo, and I'm a sculptor. When I was about 10 years old, my parents moved to Taos, New Mexico, which is an art colony. And walking through town, going home, I would look into galleries, and I would see sculptures in the windows. And that's what I wanted to do, I decided. So the seed planted, and it stuck. My mother was a potter, and I would play with her clay. So when I was a teenager, I would help her mix her clay and make sculptures out of her clay while she made pots. And then I took classes in college. But in 1967, I was drafted into the U.S. Army. I got a letter that said, greetings, which I wasn't too sure about. But I ended up in Vietnam in 1967 in November. And on January the 8th in 1968, we got caught in an ambush in an open rice field. There were about 40 of us. And I made it to the jungle and got into this little mud depression, and someone threw a hand grenade at me, and that was the last time I would see the light of day.
What was your feeling after that, knowing how much you wanted to just see in general, but with your artwork?
Well, once I ended up in the hospital and out of few surgeries, I wondered what was going to happen because my dreams were always to be a sculptor. And so laying in the hospital bed 3 months later, this volunteer came along and asked if there was anything that I wanted. And I asked for some water-based clay. And 3 days later, she came by and she bought the clay. And I looked at it for a while, uncertain whether I'd be able to make anything or not with one good hand. And I tore off a piece. And like a little child, when you give them clay, they roll out a little snake quite often. And that's what I did, back to basic one and step one. And I pinched off the ends and made a little inchworm. And the minute I made that inchworm with its little head up in the air with the little eyes and the mouth, I knew that I could still sculpt. And I was so excited because I still had my dream and I knew what I was going to do with the rest of my life.
Tell me about your process. How do you create your sculpture?
First, you have to have an idea. And there are pieces that I made from when I could see or from reading books or things that people are saying in a conversation. All of a sudden, I'll get a visual imagery becomes extremely important. So I've got a picture in my mind's eye. And from that image, I start thinking about it and it starts growing. And that's how it begins. And then one day, I sit down at a work table, and if it needs armature, then I'll create an armature, and if it's a standing piece, and if not, then I start molding, shaping wax, and building it up, and eventually build. Like when you're making the sculpture of a torso, you have to think about where the bones are. So you start with that internal portion, and then you think about where the muscles are, and then the movement. What is this piece doing, and where are you going with it? And so it has to flow, and it has to stand there and tell you by itself what it is, what it's doing. So it just can't be someone just standing there with no motion, no anything, because everything moves. So, but subtle movements, soft movements. I think my pieces are very gentle in their movements, and as time progresses, they become more fluid and more graceful, I believe. I made them by touch, so I want people to see them, because I like to go see things. After we had our papal audience in Rome. We went throughout Italy with a letter of introduction, photos of my work, and looked at many pieces by Bernini, Michelangelo, Donatello's David, just so many pieces. And the people in the museums were incredible. They would give me a guard, and they would let me touch sculptures. I touched the wrestlers, and after 3 hours of looking at sculptures in that museum, he asked me, "Do you want to touch the discus thrower?" It was one of the saddest moments, because at the beginning, my mind wants to absorb and see everything, and my hand can't work fast enough. But then after 3 hours, my mind is getting tired and starts getting distortions because I'm trying to absorb too much. And so I had to say, I can't give it. Do it justice. So I couldn't, I didn't touch the discus thrower, and that was so sad.
And you want people to have that same experience.
Same feeling, yes.
We're in front of one of your pieces. It's called The Last Dance. Tell me about this and help me touch my way through it.
Okay. The wings are important in an eagle dancer, and this is an eagle dancer. So when I make the piece, The wings are, there's a steel bar that comes across there because the wings need stability. And the feathers are actually cloth dipped in wax. And so the wax I press on, I heat it with a hair dryer and texture it and move it around and smooth it out. And the head, his head mask I made separately and laid it to the side. And but first of all, before I made the feathers and the mask, I made the man. Now, I had to decide which way, what he was doing. So, of course, I'm hopping around in my studio trying to get the motion and the feeling of the piece. Because if you put yourself inside them, you can get more feeling into it. And there's more spirit behind it.
And you can tell he's kind of crouched down, the muscles and everything are just perfect.
And so he's going to spin around and go dancing off. But the man, there was an armature inside the man's body. And so this was in oil-based clay this time. And so it was very soft. And the wings were laying on the table. I made them on the table. So after I made the man and he was ready, I took the wings off the table, flung them up in the air and flipped them over and put them on his back. And that was the first time I had seen him with his wings on him, and I put his cap on. But then I had to take him off, and when I took it off, of course, the wax being much harder than the oil-based clay, I had to refinish areas where it had been touched because it got dented and scratched a little.
But it's wonderful because there are smooth spots and there are textured spots and there are just, when you do touch it, you do feel more connected with the piece.
It varies in the texture, and I think it has good movement. And the reason I named it Last Dance was there are a few other eagle dancers that I made and a few other Indian dancers, and I decided I was never going to make another Indian dancer. And so I called it The Last Dance, and that's where that name came from.
So this is the last of the dancer series. What, will you ever stop sculpting?
What for?
You're never going to stop touching, are you?
No. Yes. It's hard to imagine. Yeah.
What do you want people to take away when they come to one of your exhibits and see your work and touch your work? What feeling do you want them to take with them?
I want them to feel with our hands, because so much of everything we do and in our life, we want to touch things. So I want them to touch them. And if it makes them happy, great. It makes me happy. If I can evoke some sort of emotion of pleasure or whatever. And if they don't like it, that's great too. Because you can't make everyone happy. But as long as I'm happy making them and creating them, hopefully many other people will enjoy them as much as I do in a different way.
Well, I'm happy. Thank you so much for creating and for sharing these.
Thank you.
Deciding to become a professional and retire as one are two of the most emotional choices a dancer can make. Former Dance Kaleidoscope dancer Mariel Greenlee credits a mentor for both getting her started and helping her finish a long and successful career. In 2019, when she decided to step away from the stage to focus on choreography and teaching, it was her mentor, Keisha Lolama, who was there for her once again. Keisha created part of a program that included a series of highly emotional and timely dances. Keisha's focused on the issue of sexual harassment. I spent an afternoon with them at rehearsal, where the two were going over the program with other Dance Kaleidoscope members.
All right, here we go. Once more, take two. Ready?
Mariel Greenlee, dancer.
Keisha Lolama, and choreographer.
When I met Keisha, I was halfway through college at Point Park University. I had transferred in, and I had gotten to a point where I was supremely burnt out and considering not pursuing dance as a profession and just trying to find something else, that I just didn't know if the life and the lifestyle and the environment were the best, most healthiest, wonderful place for me personally. I was questioning everything. And the thing about mentors is, you know, they come in all forms. Sometimes you seek them out, sometimes it's serendipity. Sometimes they teach you what you're seeking, sometimes they teach you things that you don't want to know but should. And Keisha just happened to fall full-time into my life at a moment when I was questioning everything. And she not only believed in me, but probably the greatest gift is at that time she taught me how to believe in myself, which is exactly what I needed. And it's a pretty powerful thing.
There's a moment in the... I just start crying. there's a moment in the dance, you know, where she turns and looks at the other dancers, and for me, it's... I wanted to give her a reflective moment on her career and her journey. For me to share this moment with her is there... I can't put it into words. It's special, you know, to have this... my choreography be her final performance here is... there are no words to explain that. It's quite extraordinary.
How about the pros and cons of being a female choreographer in the dance world?
I mean, it is a male-dominant industry, but for me, I've been so blessed personally. I looked back and doing this piece on this particular concert with the themes that are surrounding it, I've had many female artistic directors, from Nan Giordano to Lori Eisenhower to Debbie Diggs from DCDC. Most of my career has been women helping me, saying, we want to provide this opportunity for you, open this door. And I don't know, I feel like my perspective has been a little bit different. It's a little bit challenging, you know, to get in there, but I've been blessed where they say women should help women, and I'm the result of that.
Are you ready, dancers?
Most women have had experiences of, be it firsthand, secondhand, lukewarm, to the worst extreme of the experience. I think the issue of sexual harassment is not too abstract for most women. And to have really dug into, you know, Keisha led us through some education, some further research, and we did a lot of personal sharing of our own stories amongst each other. So the connection of the dancers on stage is pretty powerful. We're friends and we're loving family to begin with, and then add some bonding through by way of traumatic experiences. And that's, if you could stand on the stage inside of the dance, I don't think you could not cry. And it has a really beautiful, empowering message and finale. And I think that, I think it's going to be a wonderful gift for the audience. And I think it's a wonderful gift to these dancers from Keisha to go all the way to the dark side and to come out stepping into the light.
Yeah, when in doubt, especially there, because you're in a different mode. It's not about you. It's about an extension of him, so it should be out. Yeah, the whole line. So whenever you make a choice like that, just think out. Yeah. Great question.
I think storytelling, that is definitely my greatest asset. I think that's my greatest strength. Because I have such a strong theater background, I really think it's important to make dances, especially in the concert world, that resonate with audiences. I want audiences to feel something. I want to provoke emotion and thought. But for me, it needs to be something that's tangible and that's relatable. This piece certainly is all of those things. I feel like the audience is going to watch these different stories unfold about real people and real situations, and they're going to walk away appreciative, compassionate, a little bit more empathetic, and possibly reflect upon their own. I think the challenge for me for this specific topic was, how do you end on a positive note with something so serious and often painful and traumatic? So for me, it was about finding those moments of empowerment and what can happen when you do speak up, and what can happen when you talk and you surround yourself with support and you can really rally together and make the change that needs to be made.
I even kind of questioned which show would be the show to bow out on, and I felt like I needed to say goodbye. You know, it's a gift to be able to walk away with participating in that decision and not get taken out in the night by an injury. But definitely I'm pushing my body to its limits, but it's 100% worth it to have that closure and to say goodbye to my peers, to say goodbye to the stage, to say goodbye to the Indianapolis audience, and to do so with the language of the person who was there when I was just getting started. It's kind of as good as I could have dreamed it to be.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. So I can't thank you enough. And I'll see you tonight. So we'll be able to hang out tonight. You know what I mean? So go relax a little bit.
Still to come on Curious Mix, desperately seeking Sinatra.
You will say this is impossible, but it cannot be. Never heard him sing.
And a timeout.
And it was pretty much all we could do to haul ourselves down to Lock Miller's or someplace downtown or Sam's and have a drink and a little bite to eat and then head home. Mostly a drink.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix.
Thank you.
Since 1982, every 4 years, the city of Indianapolis hosts the Quadrennial International Violin Competition. 40 of the world's most talented up-and-coming violinists spend 2 weeks practicing and performing for a competition with such world prestige, it's simply known as the Indianapolis. It's also been the subject of two video documentaries created for WFYI Productions by Emmy Award-winning producer and Curious Mix contributor Gary Harrison. Gary shares some of his favorite moments from the 2018 documentary titled Thank You for the Challenge. It includes an interview with the 2018 gold medalist, Richard Lynn.
You've been playing, practicing nonstop for how many days here in Indianapolis? Over a week, for sure. Are you exhausted?
I am. I am exhausted. I'm not regretting at all. I love challenging to see what my limitation is, but mentally and physically. It's very, very demanding. I'm sure after this, I'm not gonna play the violin for a week or two, because I really need a break.
What I do in terms of making the documentary is nothing, of course, compared to what the young violinists have to do. But still, putting the documentary together is a pretty big job. I mean, we're talking about a team of more than 40 dedicated, hardworking men and women, all hitting the ground, running and gunning, because running and gunning is what it takes to capture 3 solid weeks of on-stage and behind-the-scenes violin competition activity. And then there's the year you're gonna need to slice and dice the more than 400 hours of documentary and performance footage to get it down to just 1 hour. Some of my favorite moments of the 1 hour final program happened when we knocked on the door of room 319 at the La Quinta Airport Inn on the far west side of Indianapolis.
Hi, come on in.
And met Marco Spallone.
I'm Marco Spallone.
And Marco's wife, Anne Longtine.
I'm Anne Longtine.
Anne and Marco are not young violinists competing in the Indianapolis. They don't even play the violin. But they ended up being two of the 2018 documentary's biggest stars. That's the kind of magic that happens when you do what they did.
We purchased the entire package to attend every single one of the performances of the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis.
38 preliminary round recitals, 16 semifinal recitals, and 12 concertos.
That's right. Perfect attendance over 16 days of nonstop concert performances. Morning concerts, afternoon concerts, evening concerts, late evening concerts.
Do you remember how many hours of music that we were going to be listening to all together?
No, my brain has been addled. I calculated it once, but it's
with
gone.
Something like 74 hours
yeah.
worth of music.
Yes, in 17 days, 16 days.
Being there, in your seat, for every note of every performance, that's a big deal in itself. But add to that that Anne and Marco are out-of-towners. They live 2 hours away from Indianapolis in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Too far to drive back and forth every day, which is why they set up camp in room 319 at the La Quinta Airport Inn, not 15 minutes from any of the 3 concert venues.
We have laughed. Marco prefers row H. I prefer row, which is the one right behind it. I don't.
J, because they skip row I.
And our marriage has survived.
Anne and Marco and the Indianapolis have been friends for a long, long time.
Starting in 1990, we've been coming every 4 years.
Although the competition officially begins in early September, Anne and Marco spring into action much earlier.
Probably 6 months ahead of time, or even before that, they post the repertoire and we immediately print it out and then go through and make sure what we have and what we don't have.
What follows is a mad dash to locate recorded performances of every piece of music the competitors might possibly choose to play. For the 2018 competition, that meant rounding up 158 pieces of music. Then it's time for the really fun part.
Listening.
Listening. We started doing some
kind
really...
Become familiar with the pieces.
Yeah.
A typical day during the competition starts with waking up and getting some breakfast here at the at La Quinta. And in fact, actually, it starts with me going downstairs, getting two cups of coffee and bringing them back to the room for her. So she has trouble getting going without that coffee in the morning.
So I have my coffee in bed.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a great deal depends on what you're talking about, because the prelims start at 9:30.
So then we head right downtown.
Get up at the crack of dawn and trying to evaluate what the traffic is going to be, because we're not familiar with Indianapolis and the traffic flow. So we would always want to get going early and...
Yeah, and it's tiring.
Oh.
That's something I did not anticipate, is how exhausted we would be after the entire day and evening. They're not done till 10:30, so it's a lot of music, and we're
exhausted
because a lot of the music is very emotional, powerful music to
and
listen to.
These wonderful musicians, you're simply pulled right in, and they're working hard, certainly lots harder than we are. But as Marco said, there is such emotion, and we have walked out absolutely drained.
And it was pretty much all we could do to haul ourselves down to Lock Miller's or someplace downtown or Somms and have a drink and a little bite to eat and then head home, mostly a drink.
The 2018 10th quadrennial of the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis is now in the rearview mirror. Anne and Marco are back in Fort Wayne. Someone else is staying in room 319 at the La Quinta Airport Inn. But you know what'll be here before you know it? That's right, the next edition of the greatest spectacle in violins, the 11th Quadrennial Indianapolis Competition, just around the corner in September of 2022. Too early, you say, to be making plans for 2022? Well, not according to two people I know.
In September of 2022, we'll be here in Indy.
God willing, we'll still be up and around. And I'll be 80 years old. That will be just a phenomenal, wonderful thing to be able to be here for that.
Yep, which is a good reason to look forward to saying, yes, we're going to do it.
Yes, and we're going to stay healthy and very much alive.
Yep.
The International Violin Competition of Indianapolis, there really is nothing else quite like it. For Curious Mix, I'm Gary Harrison.
Many poor young women around the world struggle to manage their monthly periods because of a lack of affordable feminine hygiene products.
In 2019, a short film, Period, End of Sentence, won an Academy Award for the story of Indian women manufacturing their own pads and fighting the stigma of menstruation. Curious Mix contributor Lee Dinoon brings us a heartwarming story of Hoosier women who answered a call from the African nation of Malawi to help young girls in need.
Malawi is a small, landlocked country in the southern half of the continent. Over a decade ago, the country was in an HIV crisis, with thousands of infected babies being born. But thanks to the wide use of antiviral medications, people living with HIV are a lot healthier today. American doctor Amy Benson works in the capital city of Lilongwe in a pediatric HIV clinic that serves about 3,000 mostly rural young people from nearby townships.
Most of our patients don't have indoor plumbing. They use outhouses. A lot of people cook with wood or charcoal. So you see lots of people here walking, even in the cities, women walking with huge, huge bundles of wood on their head.
Benson, who served in the Peace Corps in Bolivia with a friend from Northwest Indiana before going to medical school, says in poor neighborhoods and villages around the world, girls tend to fall behind when they start their periods because they fear accidentally having blood-stained garments.
It's such a taboo subject and such an embarrassing thing, and the idea that someone might see and know is also just terrifying to so many of these young girls.
And that also means missing a week of school each month.
In Malawi, fewer than 10% of girls get a high school diploma. And of course, there are many, many reasons for that. But one of the reasons that people are pointing to is because of girls having their periods.
So Benson reached out to her Hoosier Peace Corps friend, Stephanie Frischi, and Stephanie's mother, Sue, to see if they would help produce some washable feminine pads for the girls in her HIV clinic.
Steph said, maybe, yeah, let me think about it. Let me look into it. And, you know, a week later, she already had people involved and diagrams of how it was going to work.
Endearingly dubbed the Kotex Project, the Frischies got to work.
You know, we're trying to find busy fabrics, and so we picked this one.
I like the stripe.
Yeah.
And where's the one with the dots? That's my favorite.
You like the dots.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, there's a wrap, and so the wrap has cotton on the outside and inside, and the waterproof barrier in between those layers. You can't see or feel.
Within a couple of months, thanks to individual donations of money, fabric, and sewing expertise, 133 washable feminine hygiene sets were headed to Malawi.
So my mother-in-law brought a giant suitcase filled with these beautiful, colorful pads, then lots and lots and lots of layered flannel pieces as well.
Benson says the girls were thrilled with their precious gifts.
They were so excited on the day that we gave them out. And we have these teen mentors who are young adults living with HIV who come back and provide support and almost like a camp counselor at these teen clubs. And they all wanted some. They wanted them. And even the people who work in the clinic said, oh, can I have one for my daughter? And everyone, they were such a hit and a success. And I think partially because they're so beautiful. I mean, they're really, really beautiful.
The only problem? There weren't enough to go around. So the Kotex 2 project was born. Sue Frischi was touched by an email from Benson describing the lack of education about menstruation and the primitive means the girls use.
The girls were embarrassed. You know, they just didn't have much to work with other than rags, and she said leaves. And so I think they can have more confidence in being able to be out in public, going to school. And they're learning that this is not something unusual, that this is perfectly normal, and this is how you can adjust to it and still do your regular life.
Photos and stories of the project reached social media, and more women wanted to volunteer.
For me, from my viewpoint, this is right down to the ground grassroots feminism. This is saying, I'm willing to step up, and I don't care where you're located, and I will help you, sister, because you shouldn't have this issue impeding your education, your employability, or your ability to thrive.
Mary Kay Emrich is director of the Newton County Public Libraries.
Something as simple as feminine hygiene, we all take it for granted. How many of us grew up in homes where when that time came, our mother said, well, it's in the, you know, where it is in the bathroom, or it's in the closet, or took you shopping. And these young women don't have that option.
As the women spend time piecing the pads together, they shared their own personal stories of when their periods began and what it meant to them. Taboo subjects, even in the U.S., but such universal emotional experiences for women young and old.
To realize that a few pieces of fabric and some thread can change a girl's life, that's emotional. And that brings tears, that just this little piece of fabric we're sewing is going to make that much difference for one young girl. That's mind-blowing.
And make a difference it does.
This past Saturday, I saw some of the girls who we gave pads out to and asked them specifically how they work. I was just wondering, does it stop it from leaking? Do they work? And the response was, yes, they definitely work. They like them.
Benson's mission is to improve the quality of life of her patients.
I think it's really, really important to keep girls in school, and I'm a big believer in that. But it's also just a matter of human dignity.
The Northwest Indiana so-called Kotex 2 project yielded enough feminine hygiene sets and underwear for 492 more teen girls in Malawi. For Curious Mix, I'm Lee DeNoon.
How does a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
This poem is by Aaron Fogel from his book, The Printer's Error, Miami University Press. It's called The Man Who Never Heard of Frank Sinatra. The man who had never heard of Frank Sinatra, he lived a perfectly ordinary life in America. Born in 1915, he followed all the fads, read the newspapers, listened to television, knew who Dean Martin and Sammy What's-His-Name were, Sinatra's friends. But somehow, by a one in a zillion fluke, whenever Sinatra came up, he was out of the room. Or his attention was diverted by something else, and you will say this is impossible, that it cannot be, never heard him sing. Like a man in my generation who somehow missed the Beatles, though he had heard everything else. Once, just as he was about to hear the name Frank Sinatra, a plane flew overhead. He was 55 years old, his hearing a little more impaired. He had heard of Humphrey Bogart, of Elizabeth Taylor, of Walter Cronkite, and of perhaps 140,000 other celebrities' names by the time he died. And yet he had never heard of Frank Sinatra. The Greeks had that famous saying, "The luckiest man is he who was never born," which is kind of gloomy, but I think they were wrong. The luckiest man is he who never heard of Frank Sinatra.
So it's kind of hard to decide how the author really feels about Frank Sinatra then, isn't it?
I guess Mr. Fogel doesn't think much of Frank Sinatra. And, you know, you hear bad things about Frank in his life. He was with the mob, and, you know, anybody that famous is going to maybe not be a nice person all the time. But part of me likes to think that it's just the magic of that chance, going through your whole life and not hearing one of the most famous names in our culture. Maybe that's what he means. It's probably not what he means, but I like to think that.
Makes you really think about it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I've thought about it, and I can't figure it out. I emailed him. And I haven't heard back, so I think he wants it to stay a mystery.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next time with another poem we'll never forget. Just ahead on Curious Mix, an instrumental conversation.
I like beating on stuff, and I figured it'd be better beating drums than anything else.
And a movable feast.
You can take it anywhere you want to go. It's kind of like your own little personal pocket.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. It's time to perk up our palates with little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know the tastiest places in town, especially when it comes to ethnic eats. If you want a Hoosier spin on classic Cuban food, you might want to sink your teeth into Elena Ruse.
My name is Robert Graham. I own and run Elena Ruse Cuban Cuisine. There's no Elena Ruse that works here. The story of that is the Elena Ruse is the name of my favorite sandwich. It's a turkey sandwich with roasted turkey breast, guava jelly, cream cheese. It's a hot-pressed kind of thin Cuban sandwich, and I just love it so much. It's my favorite sandwich, so I thought that would be a good name for the restaurant. We're kind of known for our empanadas. We do a wide variety of them, kind of more traditional flavors to kind of the crazy flavors. We have everything from chicken to beef, steak, black bean, spinach and feta. We do chorizo and goat cheese. And then we do crazy things like we make chocolate chip cookie one. Our chorizo and goat cheese is one of our most popular ones. We use Spanish chorizo, so it's more of like a dried curd, cured chorizo, and then goat cheese. And it's fried till it's perfectly golden crispy and super delicious. Over the last few years, my mom moved to the Miami area, and I just fell in love with Cuban food, and it was something that I thought was different, but very accessible still, and not a lot of it going on in the Midwest. And so when I got into cooking and wanted to start my own place, I was like, this is the kind of cuisine I want to do. And it's just a really fun thing because you can kind of honor the tradition of it and bring those unique flavors, but also you can take it anywhere you want to go. It's kind of like your own little personal pocket. You can just decide what you want to put in it. So the best way to enjoy our empanadas is here in our establishment. We partner with Black Circle Brewing Company, so we have all kinds of great live events. Also, at just at lunchtime, it's a great quick lunch. You can come in and get a 3-pack or a 5-pack of empanadas, and it sets you up.
Indy's jazz scene was once unrivaled. Think Freddie Hubbard, Wes Montgomery, Indiana Avenue. And while there aren't as many venues as there once was, jazz still breathes deep in Indianapolis. Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams introduces us to an indie jazz power couple.
The top floor of the Circle Center Mall isn't where one would expect to find Valerie and Kenny Phelps on this Friday afternoon, but on this day at Purdue Polytechnic High School, it's a jazz studies class, and the Phelps are just where they want to be because they feel it's a calling to sow the seeds of the love of jazz and bring along another generation of appreciative audiences. This is the Phelps Experience. Valerie is, obviously, the vocalist. Husband Kenny keeps the beat. While Kenny's been a drumming star for a couple of decades and has toured around the world with people like the renowned Dee Dee Bridgewater, the front of the stage has been a relatively recent shift for Valerie when, at the urging of family, friends, and fans, and other lead singers, moved from backup vocals to the featured voice. The Phelps work well together, a good thing when you've been married for over 25 years, and as it is in so many cases, they met at church.
He was a musician in a play, in a passion play, an Easter play, and I was singing in the choir, and my daughter was with me, and she disappeared. She disappeared, and I couldn't find her anywhere. And eventually, I found her on Kenny's lap, playing the drums. That's how we met, and we got married less than a year after we met.
So, who did you fall in love with first, Kenny, the daughter or the mother?
I think it was both. You know.
So does she play the drums now?
No, she's a pilot. So far from music. But she's done a lot better.
So speaking of music, this has been your career, Kenny.
Yes.
You're an amazing drummer. Why drums?
I like beating on stuff, and I figured it'd be better beating drums than anything else. Started just, you know, in church. And
your mother's kitchen.
My mother, yeah, pots and pans, you know, just pulling out Tupperware and spoons and forks and straws, anything that, you know, would resemble drumsticks, because they would take us to church and I'd see this guy play and I'd go home and kind of set him up. And my neighbor had a set of drums and they were just some old Ludwig set, some blue sparkle, and he was getting rid of them. And so my parents bought it for me for Christmas. And man, I played those things literally all day. If they wanted me to do anything or if I was disobedient, it was just take away the drums and I straightened right up. And it popped. You know, I started doing school presentations. I started doing studio work and started meeting all these musicians, and then stumbled into the Jazz Kitchen in 94 and met Dave Ali and Steve Ali, and it changed my whole perspective on music. Because by, you know, before then I was doing more gospel kind of R&B, traveling with plays and stuff like that, and that opened up a whole nother door.
Why jazz?
It's a melting pot of styles. You know, that was the only style that I thought you could get in and play jazz. It had Latin influence. It had some rock influence. It had hip-hop influence. And I thought, man, if I learn to play this, then I can play everything. And then the dynamics and the textures and the song form and playing with musicians, learning how to communicate, you know, without words. That was the beauty of it. And then for me, it was the brushes, it was the mallets, it was playing with your hands, and it was playing with a minimal set of drums, you know, almost like the pots and pans, minimalistic, but creating this whole sound, this soundtrack.
Valerie, like Kenny, you started off in gospel.
That's correct.
How did you end up where you are now? Because you were a backup singer for a while.
When I married Kenny, this whole another world. I was exposed to another world. And when I started hearing all this jazz and different styles, it was like my, it just, I loved it. And I immediately said, I can do that. I can do that.
How hard was it to go from the back of the stage to the front as the lead singer?
Very hard. And I was pushed. I was pushed. Here's an example. I was doing background vocals for Stacey McCracken. Phenomenal singer. She sings all around town. And she goes, Val, I want you to do a song. And just, right, I mean, just there, then.
On
no,
stage.
No time to prepare. And so that has happened to me more than once. So eventually, people started hearing me and was like, you need to do something. It was like fate.
But you were also in school. What are you studying?
Yes.
And why did you head back to school?
Well, I was doing a job, and it was basically social media and analytics, and I didn't have a degree in it, and I loved it, and they allowed me to do it. So I said, well, let me just do this for real. I quit my job. I go to school full time. And then when I get my degree, I can do it for artists, because I want it all to be, that's how I'm going to connect the dots. I can do it for artists. I can do it for Kenny and our music group and what we're doing.
Kenny, 10 years from now, what are you two doing?
Well, we've got some other things, irons in the fire with our music group as it pertains to helping other people who want to come along in this business. And not just the music, but how to become a professional musician. And what are the other opportunities in this career that can keep me connected to what I love? So that's what we're trying to do now with our company, more so giving them an opportunity to see the industry from a broader perspective. Most of the time we focus on performance, but there are so many avenues: sound, lighting, marketing, videography, photography, you know, just to name a few, you know, in the industry that are not widely promoted, but people have jobs, you know, in this industry. So we want to expose them to that.
We have schools that are already interested in this program too. I didn't mean to cut you off, baby. But it's called the Night Owl Session. The Night Owl Session. And it's connected to Owl Music Group. And we just did it for University of Indianapolis, and we're going to be doing it for Butler Summer Camp with potential jazz kids and all of that. And this is a really good program.
So it's paying it forward. You know, there are so many people who have done it for us. And anytime you have to meet, opportunity is always coupled with responsibility.
With Valerie and Kenny Phelps, this is Bob Williams for Curious Mix.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this Curious Mix was created by
Gary Harrison,
Lee Danoon,
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Bob Williams,
Joe Bainline,
Adam Gross,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.